You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
When House Speaker John Boehner criticizes the Affordable Care Act, he argues that it will destroy the best health care delivery system in the world. The Gallup poll found that a large majority of Americans rate their own coverage as excellent or good, but only a third rate the coverage in the country that highly. And everyone agrees that the United States has the most expensive health care in the world. In their new book, The American Healthcare Paradox, Why Spending More Is Getting Us Less, Elizabeth Bradley, professor of public health at Yale University, and Lauren Taylor, a presidential scholar at Harvard Divinity School, offer a different view of the real costs of American health care and what can be done about them. Their book is published by Public Affairs, and I'm very pleased it brings Elizabeth Bradley and Lauren Taylor to our show today. Hello.
Hello. So nice to be here.
Elizabeth, what's the paradox in American health care?
Yeah, thanks. The paradox is really that we, compared to all other countries in Western Europe and Scandinavia, we're spending vastly more money per capita than these countries, and yet our health outcomes are among the worst for many health outcomes, not all of them, but many of them. So you have to ask, why is that? How could we be spending more but getting less?
In what areas are Americans seeing particularly poor results in terms of their health care?
Well, we have higher infant mortality, we have higher maternal mortality, we have greater rates of disability, greater rates of heart disease, adult onset diabetes. The list really goes on and on.
And on average, how much more are Americans spending per year?
Actually, our per capita spending is about $8,000 per person, give or take, and the average in another OECD countries, our high-income countries, is about half that.
Lauren, of the many measures of health like life expectancy or infant mortality, which causes you the most concern when you look at the trends in the United States?
I don't know which one causes me the most concern, but I would say there's a pretty clear thread among the ones that we don't do so well on, and that would be that they are heavily, heavily influenced by social, behavioral, and environmental conditions. So when you look at life expectancy, infant mortality, low birth weight, these things where we really just seem to not get our money's worth, they are things that really we can't get at necessarily, or the data suggests we're not doing a good job getting at through our huge healthcare investment, this enormous medical infrastructure we've created.
Didn't a study out of the University of Wisconsin find that life expectancy is declining for women in about 43% of the nation's counties?
Yeah. You know, I didn't see that study. Maybe Betsy did. She can chime in. But I would say that it doesn't surprise me, you know, particularly with the recession. We just don't have a great formula for getting at this metric because it is so complex and born of so many factors, many of which are just really inextricably immersed into kind of our day-to-day living conditions.
But Betsy, doesn't that go against the trend? Women have always lived longer than men.
Exactly. That's why that one study was very, very interesting to see what could be happening exactly with a gender differential of this direction. One of the questions that's very difficult for most scholars of health services research, such as the scholars of that paper, is the data often is restricted to the medical care system and the kinds of medical care people are getting. And we don't actually have a good way to research thoroughly what about the other things that make us healthy, such as housing, our educational levels, our nutrition, our physical exercise, you know, the way our relationships are. These are things that decades of research have shown unequivocally are important for health. But in our studies of what's happening epidemiologically in our country, we tend not to have the spending on those variables. We tend only to look at the medical care system, and I think we're getting only part of the story.
The Wisconsin study shows a gender differential. Are there also differences according to race or economic status?
Absolutely, and this is well known. We absolutely do have health disparities. According to race and according to income and according to education, has been that way in most countries across the globe and certainly in the United States.
Now, Lauren, the New York Times has been running a series of reports by Elizabeth Blumenthal that look at how individual procedures and services cost much more in the United States. Does your study explain why those costs are so much higher here?
I think it does in part. I mean, costs, of course, are borne by a number of factors, some of which are demand. And we found in the United States that there is just an incredible demand for the latest and greatest medical technology and medical interventions. That's kind of a cultural norm here, that when we fall ill, we seek a medical intervention, and we do so on a very individual basis. We like our physicians. We may not like how much they cost, but we may not even know how much they cost. And so, unlike many of the countries we visited in Western Europe and Scandinavia, medicine continues to be the primary means of recourse, and that, as we found, you know, may not be the most effective means. There may be alternate modes of intervention that have to do with changing social circumstances, behavioral patterns, and your environment that would provide a more sustainable fix at a lower cost.
But, Betsy, don't you argue that the United States is not as big a spender as people think? How is that possible?
That's a really important question, and I love the opportunity to make this very clear. Most of our studies that say the United States is spending more than all these other countries are looking at how much we're spending on health care. But if we actually step back for a minute and say, well, how much are we spending on other things that make us healthy as a society, those would include a whole category of social services that are things like housing, employment supports, old age assistance, you know, nutrition supplements, education. If we add together what the United States is spending on healthcare plus what the United States is spending on all these other services, and we compare that sum of money to what England, Canada, countries in Scandinavia are spending on that same total amount, we're actually somewhere in the middle. We no longer are a high spender. We're kind of in the middle, and we have sort of in the middle or poor outcomes to match it.
So, Lauren, is this a cultural thing? Do Americans treat health like a thing to be bought, like a car or a house?
I think you've hit on it. Yes, that was a major finding for us. You know, we began kind of with an examination of policy and spending, but when we really dug deep into why do we spend in this way, why does the United States so prioritize healthcare spending over social service spending, we really got quickly to an issue of culture, and that was kind of confirmed when we went to some other countries, Norway, Sweden, Denmark, and we felt very clearly that that was a different approach to health. In some of the other countries we visited, health was viewed quite holistically, and by that I mean it was viewed as a product of all sorts of factors. You know, as I mentioned earlier, your home, kind of your exercise habits, what you eat, they took these things very seriously. Here in the United States, I think we know that these things intellectually have an impact. You know, we've heard the studies for years, and yet, as I mentioned earlier, we do reach for that medicine quite quickly. And I think that has a lot of reasons, one of which may be that the system is just so large and there's so much profit being made and there's a lot of advertising and lobbying that goes into a system that tells us as Americans that, you know, health care and medical intervention can be provided quickly and effectively. And so we do reach for it, perhaps more often than we actually, quote unquote, need it.
My guests are Lauren Taylor, a presidential scholar at Harvard Divinity School, and Elizabeth Bradley, professor of public health at Yale University. Their book, The American Healthcare Paradox, Why Spending More is Getting Us Less. Well, as you mentioned, other countries spend more on social programs like welfare, unemployment benefits, old age pensions, other things like that. Haven't many of those things come under attack from conservatives recently?
Yeah, that's very important. That I think the take-home message from the book is definitely not that this is a panacea. And we know in the United States that we have had all kinds of attacks on the social service system, I think both for value-laden reasons and also just straight expedient reasons and understanding the cost-effectiveness of this. What we haven't done yet in the United States, however, is look holistically at the spend for both healthcare and the social services at once and see what's the productivity of that full spend. That's something that our perspectives, we're in a silo between healthcare and the rest of the services. So it's hard for us to take a step back and say, how effective are they together? is there a way in which we can coordinate these and develop exciting experiments, even at a grassroots level, that allow one to really get the most out of the social service dollar and the most out of the healthcare dollar because they're better coordinated. That's what we're missing.
So you don't want to separate them? Because I was wondering, of these additional expenditures, which have the clearest benefit in terms of health?
Yeah. You know, it's not 100% clear from research which has the best benefit from health because these are holistic things that work together. So it will be important, I think, and we in the American way have a great opportunity to really do a lot of experimentation of different ways to integrate social and healthcare services to potentially get a bigger bang for our buck in terms of health.
Lauren, in an essay in the New York Times in 2011, the two of you, summarized your argument saying, before we spend even more money, we should consider allocating it differently. Wouldn't straight allocation mean depriving some of the direct medical expenditures they currently use?
Yeah, and I think that that's one option, but it's not the only option. And, you know, as you do these studies and you get out there and you test it with people, I think you develop a keener sense of what kind of the market is willing to do. So I think allocating funds differently is one option. I think another one is really tasking the healthcare sector, which we have and which is so influential and so large, it's now over 17% of GDP, with responsibility for some of these population health outcomes like the low birth weight, the infant mortality, the life expectancy, which we have historically done poorly on. You know, the things that the healthcare sector has considered itself accountable for historically are things we've done well in. So in international rankings of knee replacements, we're at the top of the list. In international rankings of people living with a kidney transplant, we're at the top of the list. And these are things that the medical sector has traditionally seen itself as accountable for. Those have been profit centers. And so what do you know? The United States has done incredibly well. So I think another option that would not necessarily require reallocation of finances, but reallocation of accountability or responsibility, would be to hand some incentives or dangle some incentives, if you will, in front of the healthcare sector for these different outcomes. And that may actually be an alternate means of getting some more effectiveness for the dollars we are already investing.
Do you include programs like maternity leave or sick leave in your broader comparisons of healthcare across countries, or is that already included in standard measures?
I think that that was included in the social service expenditures that we looked at in the original OECD data, but Betsy, do you remember exactly?
Yes, it is included. Anything that has some kind of sort of tax subsidy for those kinds of things is included and in measured the same way using the OECD data across the different countries. So I think our main goal was to sort of look at how we may be different from the other countries, and so that is included and that's sort of measured in a particular way. There's a lot of debate of exactly how to measure it, so I wouldn't want to say we've done the end-all definitive research on that, but that has been included thus far.
Well, if we include things that are not obviously health-related, should we also include quality of life things like public transportation or electricity supply?
Yeah. It's really a critical question in the long run. Which do we really consider the social services and which are other things that are infrastructure? Like electricity, et cetera. I think that one can go a little bit far with this. Ultimately, we have to draw lines at where we think these are services that really have some empirical evidence that they produce better health outcomes. And while we could tell a story about electricity doing that, we really have no empirical data that would allow us to capture it in very granular detail. However, in contrast, some of the social services like education, housing, employment supports, these are very well documented what their impact on health is and sort of make a more credible, I think, hypothesis and argument.
My guests are Elizabeth H. Bradley, Professor of Public Health at Yale University, Faculty Director of its Global Health Leadership Institute and Master at Brandford College, and Lauren A. Taylor, who studies public health and medical ethics at Harvard Divinity School, where she is a presidential scholar. They have co-authored a book called The American Healthcare Paradox, Why Spending More is Getting Us Less. It is published by Public Affairs, and we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back with Elizabeth Bradley of Yale and Lauren Taylor of the Harvard Divinity School, the co-authors of The American Healthcare Paradox, Why Spending More is Getting Us Less. It's published by Public Affairs, and we've been getting a number of questions written in by our listeners. One person asked, people have been talking about inflation and healthcare costs for years. Are costs going up at a slower rate in other countries?
Yeah, I'm happy to address that. It depends. It depends on the countries. And we recently, over the last couple of years in the U.S., are also starting slowly to have a bit of a slowdown, but mostly due to the recession. Other countries face the same type of patterns. When they have recessions, similar type things happen.
But some people are suggesting that the Affordable Care Act is also slowing down the costs. Could that be true? It's so early in the process.
Exactly. I agree with you. And most of the research, the strong research on this, really shows the vast majority of the slowdown is most likely due to still lingering effects of the recession. And I guess another area, if we think about how could the ACA already be having impact, one thing that I think does happen, and it happened earlier when we were working on Medicare reimbursement changes, so the same huge legislations, one thing that happens is the industry generally becomes a little nervous what is going to happen. And just the threat of a longer-term regulatory environment sometimes can stall increasing expenses, but it's not a long-term shift in the way we're using resources. So in time, one can expect the expenses to increase again.
Glenn from Queens has written in to say that one doctor told him that a reason costs are so high is that there isn't enough scholarship aid to medical students, so they subsequently have to charge higher rates.
Sure. This is an issue that's come up a number of times, and I'm not sure that Betsy and I have a really clear answer for what to do about it, but certainly I think the soaring cost of medical education fuels a lot of decisions that those emerging medical students make as far as where to go into the market. You know, I think that that has a lot to do with the kind of overabundance of specialists that we have in this country as compared to many of the countries in Western Europe and Scandinavia that get the better outcomes. You know, we have a healthcare workforce that is just absolutely saturated with specialists who do high-cost, highly technical, and technologically laden interventions, as opposed to primary care physicians who act as real gatekeepers for the system and can provide kind of lower cost interventions and therefore keep overall system costs down. So I think it's a real issue. I'm not sure that we have an answer.
Another listener, Robert, says that 50% of the money for healthcare is spent on people in the last stages of their lives. I don't know if that statistic is accurate, but he asks, how do we do this less expensively?
Yeah. The statistic is not quite accurate. It's really a little bit exaggerated. The data is more 27% to 30% of Medicare expenses are spent on people, about 5 or 6% of the Medicare population who happen to die in the last year of life. So, you know, in that last year of their life, that's where that's spent. So it is a disparity. I guess the difficulty with this always has been it's very hard to know ahead of time that's what's going to happen to that person. In terms of the end-of-life cost generally, many, many studies have demonstrated the difficulty our society has with really coming to terms and using potential hospice services and other approaches, more holistic approaches that may be more cost-effective. Even with that, however, that probably would not make an enormous difference. We're so much larger in what we spend that's a bit of the story, but it really isn't the large part of the story.
Getting back to the cost of medical education, we see students from abroad incurring the same educational costs coming to this country and then returning to India or Thailand, where the costs remain low. In fact, we have a situation now where we are seeing Americans actually going there for expensive procedures as kind of medical tourism. So how are those countries able to keep the costs down?
You know, I don't want to speak to that because it's not something that I know a lot about. I'll let Betsy weigh in if she has thoughts. But, you know, medical workforce migration is complex, just like medical tourism is. And it kind of just falls outside the scope of what the book was really about. So, Betsy, do you have thoughts?
Yeah, I would just say that we can tell that the high medical cost education is not really the driver of our large healthcare spending. As you've just demonstrated, these physicians paying large prices for this, for their education, go back abroad, and then they don't fit into a system that's terribly high cost. How these other countries are able to do the same with less, in many ways, our thesis is that they don't depend quite as much on a large medical system to address what are basically social, economic, and behavioral determinants of health, which are really determining our health.
Well, do the governments that are doing better in healthcare policy count that additional spending as part of healthcare? Are the social programs consciously seen as contributing to health?
I think what's really fascinating, and particularly in Scandinavia where we visited, they tend to budget these two things together. It's the same group that would be arguing about them, the same decentralized, democratically elected, county-level government that would be saying, this is what we're spending in the school system, this is what we're spending in the healthcare system, this is what we're spending on housing, et cetera. Here's our unemployment insurance. Look at the whole taxpayer dollar there. How should we be spending it in the best way to get the best well-being of this population we're in charge of? If you look at the United States, we have an opportunity to do things like that, but we're a lot more fragmented. Where do we really have those kinds of open debates about the trade-offs between the sectors? We tend to, even with the ACA, we're regulating and thinking about all different parts of the healthcare system, but there's no discussion inside of the ACA of some of the impact on these other sectors or the other sectors' impact on the healthcare sector. And that's a part of our national deliberation that probably could change with better discourse.
But does the comparison between the U.S. and other countries change according to whether you're talking about per capita spending or percentage of GDP?
Well, the per capita or percentage of GDP, we have the same statistics come out where we're really spending double what these other countries are spending. Was that your question?
Yeah, well, sure. I was just wondering, you can always skew statistics depending on how you're using them, and I was wondering about that. Well, my guests are Elizabeth Bradley and Lauren Taylor. Their book, The American Healthcare Paradox, Why Spending More is Getting Us Less, is published by Public Affairs. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Is the added spending by other countries on social programs enough to account for the differences in health between Americans and others?
We thought it was. We thought it was the major difference between the spending allocation patterns that had previously gone unexplained. Most studies heretofore had kind of put health expenditure and health outcomes in a graph and said this is the trend and the United States is just a real outlier. And we felt like, well, there's a way to bring the United States into the trend so that everyone makes a little bit more sense. And that was incorporating the social service spending into that analysis. And I would add the United States, whether or not the United States was in that analysis, did not change the results. So the social service spending was an important factor in driving the health outcomes for all of the countries in the data set. And that was 34 Western European and Scandinavian countries, plus the U.S., Korea, Mexico, and a few others in the OECD.
Now, Lauren, are you the first people to make that connection? Because if it's clear that there are health benefits to social services, why don't we see more support for them in this country?
It's a great question. And I never like to say that we are the first to make this connection. You know, there is, particularly in public health, where both Betsy and I are trained, a long, long literature laying out the importance and the power of social determinants of health. What I think our analysis might do that is slightly new is really kind of monetize that impact and say, look, there's real financial consequence to not placing attention and investment in these social arenas. So I think that's what's new. As to why we don't do it, I think in this country there is a long history of separation between healthcare services and social services. They've been funded differently, and they've just been conceptualized quite distinctly. Healthcare has been seen often as a good to be kind of traded and purchased in a free market. You know, even Medicare and some of our government purchasers are payers that compete with private industry for prices and for goods. So there is this kind of capitalist free market feeling to the whole sector. The social service sector, on the other hand, has been largely a product of government subsidies and nonprofit work. So that has set up, you know, those two sectors are just quite distinct. They have their own barriers and regulations and different actors. And so the question of how to bring them together is a real focus of the book.
Well, you know, the Scandinavian countries do well in terms of health care, but they are the nations that are most often dismissed as socialist by many American politicians. So is the American culture, including that surrounding health care, just different when the rest of the world, the industrialized world, was moving to a single-payer system? We had President Eisenhower saying that that would be creeping socialism if we did it in this country.
Yeah, it's an important point. And the Scandinavian countries that we visited were the social democracies, so Norway, Denmark, and Sweden. And you're right, there's no question that they have larger social welfare states than the United States does. That is true. The irony, though, is if we actually look at how much the United States is spending on both the health care and the social services, we're not that different. We're really not that different. But our allocation between the two is quite different. And the sort of design of the health care system is different in terms of its ability to deal with some of the social determinants. In terms of politicians calling these countries socialists and, gee, are we going that way, we thought long and hard about this, and whatever we do in the United States, it has to be done in an American way. It has to be done with leveraging some of the amazing entrepreneurialism that we have. The question is, can we redirect some of the entrepreneurial spirit and private sector creativity, can we redirect that to products and services that are rewarded for keeping us healthy, as opposed to being rewarded for taking care of people who are sick and potentially then sustaining illness? How do we create that same sort of entrepreneurial capitalism, great spirit and coordination that is rewarded for keeping our population healthy? We've yet to figure that out, but I think the American brain can do it.
Jane Mayer reported on the State Policy Network in The New Yorker and Britain's Guardian newspapers just reported on conservative plans to slash many public sector rights and services on the state level across the United States. And on a federal level, President Obama has voiced support for cutting Social Security by changing how inflation is calculated. Is the trend on social programs in the U.S. going in the opposite direction to what we see in the rest of the world or what you might recommend? Betsy?
Yeah, I'm happy to answer that. Yeah, it's a good question. Well, as we think about cutting some of these social services, we really have to be wise about over 5-10 years, what will that do to the healthcare dollar? Will we cut a social service now that ultimately we will just pay more later in healthcare spending? A lot of our research says yes, we will. However, another approach, if we have to economize on the social services, is to then think, okay, how are we going to use this healthcare dollar? And that's not going to make hospital administrators and physicians that happy to say now even more of the social and economic problems are going to be dumped in the lap of the emergency room, et cetera, et cetera. In the book, we profile a number of both patients, clients, and physicians who really suffer with this problem, where they'd like to be practicing medicine, but what they see in their emergency rooms are really issues that have nothing to do with biology, have nothing to do with medicine per se, but have to do with homelessness, have to do with other kinds of social and economic problems, behavioral problems that really the medical care system is not ideal to address.
Well, American health insurers often offer little coverage for mental health care. President Bush signed the Mental Health Parity and Addiction Equity Act in 2008. Has that changed anything?
Yeah, the act is phenomenally important. And when we look at, just as you had asked, are there disparities in spending by education, there are disparities in spending by mental health as well, or obesity. Some of these sort of socially determined in some ways, individually determined in other ways, epidemiologic patterns end up costing enormous amounts, and mental health would be one of these. So allowing the proper prevention and allowing the proper early treatment of mental health services in a sort of parity method it has been critical. In terms of can we really show whether that has reduced costs, it hasn't been long enough. And it's hard for us to know what it would have been without that. So I wish we did have a definitive answer on that. I think the research is still to be done.
Well, from what we have very little time, and from what you've been saying, it's my sense that you feel that so-called Obamacare, the ACA, might only have some impact, but not the kind of impact that you think is really necessary.
Exactly. It's good to insure everybody. It's good to be explicit about our spending so we can manage it as a country. But it will be focusing us more and more on healthcare and hopefully not to the dismissal of other services that really will keep us healthy.
Thank you both so much for being on our show. Elizabeth Bradley and Lauren Taylor are the co-authors of The American Healthcare Paradox, Why Spending More is Getting Us Less. It's published by Public Affairs.
Thank you so much.
Thanks so much.